Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Stephen Daisley. Well, this morning Ruth Davidson announced her resignation as leader of the Scottish Conservatives. This is what she had to say.
This has been a remarkable time in politics and I will always be thankful for the opportunity to have a front seat as Scottish political history was being made. I am so proud of the teams that we have built as a party at Holyrood, at Westminster and in council chambers across the country. Proud too of the work that we've done to reach out to all communities in Scotland, north and south, rural or urban, and after some fallow decades, to prove ourselves a truly national party once again.
Stephen, she cited mainly personal reasons in her speech this morning. But it can't just be about that, can it?
No, I think it's fair to say that there's a bit of both going on here. Certainly, you know, she is still a relatively new mum. Her baby Finn is only 10 months old and she is planning soon to marry her partner Jen. Now, all of that brings huge pressures for anyone, but we're in a high-profile job as she is. It only amplifies it. But you can't get away from the fact that, you know, Ruth Davidson is now very much out of step with where the Conservative Party is today. She opposed Boris Johnson, you know, quite vociferously and becoming leader. She campaigned for Remain, and while she was willing to back Theresa May's deal, she made very clear that she was against no deal Brexit, which now appears to be the course that Number 10 is heading on. I think that, yes, the personal loomed large for her, but probably the decisive factor for her is the fact that the party at the UK level had just diverged so far from where her sort of liberal blue-collar politics, Toryism, was.
And is this a big blow to the Scottish Conservatives, or were they actually starting on a downward trajectory after a pretty good few years under Ruth Davidson? Is she actually quitting when she's ahead as much as anything else?
It could be, and I think that the mood among most Scottish Conservatives today is that this could be an existential event for them. It's hard to overstate how central Ruth Davidson was to the revival of the Scottish Conservatives. You know, she is, or now was, she was the party. The revival from absolutely nowhere, from the wipeout of 1997, she brought them back largely by force of her own personality, determination, you know, and endeavour. If you look at the election material from general elections in Scotland, from Holyrood elections, the words Conservative, very, very small on the leaflets and on the posters, they've all got big, big pictures of Ruth Davidson. You know, it really was the Ruth Davidson party. She was the one who connected with a lot of sort of C2 voters who had never thought of voting Conservative before, but liked her. You know, they liked her sort of can-do spirit, and they liked her defence of the union. Yes, the Scottish Conservatives have been having a difficult time lately, largely because of the fallout from Brexit. It was not, however, unrepairable. The problem now is that they have to scramble to find a new leader with even a measure of the star power that Davidson had, and it's not clear that they have any obvious candidate. And moreover, most of the candidates, the sort of candidates that would come to mind, essentially share the same views as she has on the questions of Brexit and indeed on the question of Boris Johnson himself.
James, you've reported that Boris Johnson and his advisers knew that Ruth Davidson was considering stepping down for a couple of weeks. What's the mood in Downing Street now that she has quit?
I think the Ruth Davidson-Boris Johnson relationship has always been difficult. She backed three different candidates to be Tory leader other than him. I think the first meeting between them when Boris Johnson went to Scotland with him as Prime Minister went better than expected, but I think everyone always knew it was going to be difficult. And I think if you look at this judging, this juggle we all make in our lives between the personal life and the professional life, when you cease to kind of enjoy your professional life becomes a kind of constant struggle, you ask yourself, is it worth the sacrifices? And that's clearly what's happened with her. It is clearly a combination of the two things. But if she was in total alignment with the Westminster leadership of the Tory party on every issue, I don't think she would have come to the same decision. But I think number 10 will be relieved today that Ruth Davidson hasn't gone out of a big swipe at Boris Johnson. She was as helpful to him as she could have been in that press conference, saying that he is trying for a deal and that MPs should vote for a deal if he can get one. This was, you know, actually, she was much more brutal about David Cameron than she was about Boris Johnson. But I think there is a big question mark here, which is comes back to the question of electoral strategy, which is, as Stephen was saying, it is hard to imagine. I mean, and as you were saying in your question to Stephen, even before today's resignation, it was hard to imagine that the Tories were going to keep hold of all of their Scottish seats in the event of an election. You know, for example, it's quite hard to imagine Paul Masterson's seat voting for a no-deal Tory party. Minus Ruth Davidson, that Scottish challenge becomes even bigger. And I think the question then becomes, you know, where is this Tory majority going to come from in an election? You know, where are they going to make up for these Scottish losses? And I mean, that is one of the big challenges, which is how are you planning to redraw that electoral map?
And Stephen, more widely, what does this mean for the union?
For the union, the Conservatives have lost their leader, but the union has lost its most robust champion. You know, Ruth Davidson was the face of the union, and whenever there was speculation about, you know, a second referendum, it was just sort of assumed among most commentators, most politicians, that she would of course lead the second no campaign. What was, I think, marked Ruth Davidson out from many other non-nationalist politicians in Scotland was her unionism. It wasn't defensive, it wasn't apologetic. She took something, a term like unionism, which obviously has certain historic resonances in certain parts of Scotland, and she took that and actually turned it into a philosophy with broader appeal, so that, you know, even in sort of parts of the west of Scotland, which had never really been Tory friendly, and where the union had sometimes been seen through the prism of the orange and the green, suddenly she was advancing a unionism that some people there could actually vote for. It's difficult to see who can replace her. Certainly the Scottish Labour leader Richard Leonard has been, some would say, fatally undermined by Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell on the question of NDREF 2. The Liberal Democrats are still relatively small in the Scottish Parliament, not having fully recovered from their post-coalition. It's not clear who replaces her. Today, Conservatives are mostly thinking about who will their leader be, but soon enough, you know, they're going to be turning to the question of who is the face and the champion of the union, and there isn't an obvious replacement.
James, this is obviously, presumably, a blow to anti-no-deal Conservatives as well.
I think slightly less so, in that this is all going to turn on the kind of Westminster maths, and obviously Ruth Davidson was not sitting there, and I don't think anyone expected her to kind of lead the charge against no deal. I think Westminster, what we're seeing at the moment is things are, and number 10 is trying to force this, but things might well clarify in the next week into, are you prepared to put Jeremy Corbyn in number 10? If you're not, then you have to accept that Boris Johnson is going to be allowed to pursue his Brexit strategy. I think that's where things are going down here in Westminster. I think one of the big things about the union is this, is I think at the moment it is perfectly credible for Westminster to block any request for a second independence referendum. I think if pro-independence parties win a majority at the Holyrood election in 2021, that will become much, much harder, because they will have an explicit mandate for it, more clear than they have at the moment. And also, I think by 2021, you know, what has happened with Brexit will be clearer. And so you at the moment, you could argue that any independence referendum would be taking place with voters not knowing some crucial information that they would need to know to make their decision. That position, I think, will really be slightly harder in that 2021 Parliament. And I think the kind of question becomes, in terms of a union, is, you know, does the absence of Ruth Davidson from that campaign make it that bit easier for the pro-independence parties to win a majority in that election?
And just quickly looking at those anti-no-deal Conservative MPs, James, how have they been responding today, now that the dust is settling after the prorogation announcement? We've seen a lot of pressure certainly on members of the Cabinet, such as Amber Rudd and Matt Hancock and Sajid Javid, who made comments during the leadership contest about the prospect of Parliament being prorogued. What's the wider Conservative movement on this up to now?
So I think there will be a legislative attempt to force the government to ask for an extension if it hasn't got a deal. I think that will come next week when Parliament returns. And I think you'll see a good number of Conservative MPs vote for it, you know, including lots of former ministers, you know, the likes of Philip Hammond and so on. But, and this is where I think this comes down, first of all, there's no guarantee that they will have enough time to get this done before Parliament is prorogued. And secondly, even if they could pass the law, there are lots of ways, as I say in the magazine this week, there are lots of ways for Boris Johnson to frustrate that law. You know, it is quite easy to find a way to ask for an extension in such a way that guarantees the EU will refuse the request. So I think what those Conservative rebels are going to have to decide in the next few weeks is, are they prepared to put Jeremy Corbyn in number 10 or not? Because if they're not, they can't be certain of stopping no deal. Because if they're not prepared to back an alternative government, then I think you could see Boris Johnson run down the clock during that 14-day period and then hold an election after the 31st of October once the UK has left. And so that is what it is going to turn down to. Are they prepared to back an alternative government? And I think it is. I don't think they are there yet. I think most of them still would not be prepared to cross that Rubicon.
Thank you, James and Stephen. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And maybe consider subscribing to the magazine. At the moment, we have a special deal on The Spectator where you can get 12 issues for just £12. And we'll even throw in a £20 Amazon voucher. Just head to spectator.co.uk/voucher. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow.